This is the takeaway for June 12th.
Hackers have stolen thousands of travelers' license plate data and photographs from a government contractor.
There's too many areas of vulnerability here, and it only seems to figure out that something is important and should be protected after it's hacked.
And today marks 3 years since the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando.
There was just this utter silence in my room, which I knew was completely contrasting just the horror and chaos that was going on at Pulse, a place that I basically spent my 20s kind of coming of age as an openly gay man.
Let's get started. This week, Customs and Border Protection announced that hackers had stolen license plate images and travelers' photos in what some inside the agency are calling a, quote, major incident. Hackers reportedly broke into the systems of a company called Perceptix, which operates license plate readers for the government agency. According to a preliminary report from CBP, the hack compromised the data of approximately 100,000 people. There are still lots of unanswered questions about how the biometric data ended up in the hands of hackers and what can happen when law enforcement fails to keep its data secure. Tom Claiborne is here to walk us through at least some of those questions. He's a reporter for The Register, an IT news site. And Leon Fresco joins us as well. He's the former Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department and head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration. Tom, let's start with you. What exactly was in these stolen files?
Hi. Pretty much everything at the company, it seems. It's a lot of the images in question appear to be test data from license plate readers. These are images that were captured on freeways in 2017. So they're not, I think, current information as far as we can tell. But then there's a whole bunch of other stuff in terms of like Exchange servers, you know, Microsoft Exchange email servers and internal files. And a lot of stuff that you wouldn't really care about in a data breach, like MP3 files from someone's PC. So it seems like somebody had access to sort of the entire IT infrastructure of a server run by this company.
So, Tom, a CBP official told the Washington Post that the hacked materials were limited to the U.S. border with Canada. Do you see anything that supports that or suggests otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, I looked through some of the lists of files last night, and the locations that are identifiable from the file names are things like Del Rio, Texas, Veterans Bridge in Brownsville, Texas, Columbus, New Mexico, I'm assuming, rather than Ohio, Santa Teresa, New Mexico, Hidalgo, Texas. I think there's a mention of Confederation Bridge, which I believe is in Canada. So I think their description of it is pretty consistent, but there's certainly there is quite a bit of it.
Activity both on the Canadian U.S. border and also on the U.S. southern border.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, you were contacted by the hacker directly, and it's someone who calls themselves Boris Bullet Dodger. Is it the same Boris that carried out a recent ransomware attack against a German company?
We believe so. If you're referring to the Citicomp hack last month, we believe that it's the same pseudonym, at least. It's always hard to attribute who is behind those pseudonyms. It could be one or a group of people. And this group has also been involved in other incidents, as far as we can tell. When we looked at their Tor site, which is on the dark web, there were other organizations besides Perceptix and Citicomp. So I actually corresponded with him this morning to see whether he would answer a question that I put to him, and he never got back to me about, which was about his motivation. And he confirmed that he did this for money. And he declined to give any information about the technical details of the attack. In other words, the vulnerability he's used, because he said it would compromise his ongoing operations. So,
and we just did a report on how the city of Baltimore was hacked, and also the hackers there were asking for money. Tom, did he get his money, this Boris Bullet Dodger?
We don't know. We don't know if this was if there was a ransomware demand. We haven't heard from Perceptix. They haven't said anything about that. So that would certainly fit with past precedent, but you can never tell. It could simply be, someone doesn't like the way a negotiation's going, or just doesn't like an organization and wants to dump it, or they feel like they can make more money just selling it to people online.
Leon, I want to bring you in here. What does the Border Patrol use this data for?
Well, the license plate
That is actually very important because it's tracking several things. It's tracking the frequency of cars that are coming across the border. You know, the higher frequency of a car coming across the border, you'd want to know, why is it coming across? Is it coming across for legitimate trade and commerce, or is it coming across as a smuggling entity? You'd want to match the photos to those license plates to see if the owner of the car is actually driving the car, or is it being used by a smuggling organization? And so there are legitimate law enforcement uses for these license plate and photo data, but obviously you don't want them getting into the hands of the wrong people, because if they know this information of who's coming across and how, then they can manipulate it for their ends.
And I guess that's the next question, which is, now that the data has been hacked, it's available, who else might be interested in this data from the Perceptix cameras?
Well, suppose I was a smuggler and I got information that showed me 30,000 cars that come into the border three times a week, and maybe they're coming in to just perform normal housework, or maybe they're coming in for gardening or whatever else. Those people are subject to potential blackmail, extortion, and attacks by smugglers who say, look, you better also smuggle drugs in for me, or I will kidnap you or attack your family. Or they may even unwittingly use these cars and put things in the cars and collect them at their location without the person even knowing that they were an accomplice to smuggling drugs or other contraband. And so from that perspective, this information getting into the wrong hands can, in fact, be very dangerous.
I'm speaking with tech reporter Tom Claiborne and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General Leon Fresco about the data breach at the border. Leon, let's talk a little bit about what is considered a privacy right at the border. First, are there? Does anyone have any privacy rights at the border? And tell us what the difference is there.
Well, sure. So from the perspective of all non-citizens, your privacy rights at the border are basically nothing, because that's where the immigration law has made it very, very clear that if you're trying to enter the United States as a non-citizen, you have no rights. You're at the complete mercy of the Border Patrol. And then even if you're a citizen, you don't have the rights to your license plate information, to the extent that your license plate is public. It's everybody can see it. And so to say that you would have a privacy right over your license plate is not the case. But the problem is, when the government compiles this information and it starts merging it with other information that is attendant to your license plate, then the question is, well, what privacy rights do you have to your whole pattern of movement, which is what the government ends up tracking? And that's where this becomes a problem, because as the government collects this data that can then be consolidated with other data so that we know more things about you, and then that data gets in the hands of other people that can easily exploit it, that's where the problem is. And so this is where the policymakers have to do much more work in terms of, even if you have a thing like a license plate, which you have no privacy rights over, well, what is that data being combined with, and should it be, or should we not collect this data then because of the fear of what it can lead to?
And also off of that point, Tom, this data is also available on the dark web, and there are privacy implications involved in that, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. A lot of what can happen with the data depends upon the, you know, sophistication and motives of those trying to use it. You know, at a very simple level, it could be something as, you know, like looking for credit card information and abusing that for identity theft. But as Mr. Fresco pointed out, the risks of taking this data and combining it with other data sets raises a whole bunch of other potential scenarios that are undesirable for people. And you know, it's been shown that data can be, that had been, you know, anonymized can be de-anonymized. And, you know, when it's combined with other data sets, you have the ability to track specific individuals and their movements, potentially to know who they're meeting with. It could be abused not only by terrorists, but by people who are trying to find out information about law enforcement, for example, by, you know, because there will be those sorts of people who are captured, and the images may have face pictures, because they may not just be license plates. It depends on how they're framed. And there was a whole bunch of other information that's non-image oriented that was in this breach that tells about, you know, contracts and people involved in these systems. So all of that raises, you know, potential questions. The issue, I think, for a lot of companies and organizations is how they retain the data and how they store it, because you know, best practice generally seems to be that you, you know, break it into parts and encrypt it and hold as little of it as possible. You know, among security and privacy people, you'll often hear it said that data is a toxic asset because it exposes you to so much liability if you fail to keep it safe.
Leon, how concerning is cybersecurity for the CBP? I mean, how far along are they in knowing how to deal with these types of hacks and attacks?
I think the problem is, in all of these different agencies, we're fighting the last war. So now CBP knows that it has problems with subcontractors hacking, being hacked, and so now it will deal with that, and then something else will emerge. And so what happens is, we're not at a proactive front on cybersecurity at A, all of our agencies, B, for all of their uses, and then C, for their contractors, and then D, for their subcontractors. And so there's too many areas of vulnerability here, and it only seems to figure out that something is important and should be protected after it's hacked. And so that's the problem, is that the amount of targets are infinite, basically, at this point, and the amount of resources for cybersecurity that the government can focus on are finite. And so you only realize that a certain data set could actually be exploited and can be used for the detriment of the American people once it's hacked. And so this is the number one 21st century challenge for the government, is to say, how can we take our finite cybersecurity resources and employ them in a way where we're actually saying up front, this is how you have to protect every piece of data that you have. And how are we actually thinking about this in a way where we're not collecting data and storing it unless it's absolutely, absolutely necessary? All of this seems to be going on without any thought being given to it whatsoever. And so this is why we keep seeing these ad hoc terrible events happening.
And Tom, what, in your opinion, as a reporter here that covers these things, what needs to change? I mean, what's the most effective way that governments can protect their data?
Just simply to keep less of it. And also to have more transparency. I mean, a lot of the problems that we come into is we don't know exactly what's out there and what the risks are, because these organizations don't have any kind of mandatory disclosure, at least in some states. In, you know, California, we're likely to see a privacy breach notice on this, since Californians appear to have been affected. But, I mean, as we understand it, the data is still available online through a tool called rsync, despite what has been said about this. So there's a lot of energy that needs to be put into having less data to be exposed.
Tom Claiborne is a cybersecurity reporter for The Register, and Leon Fresco is the former Deputy Assistant Attorney General who headed the Office of Immigration Litigation under President Obama. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you.
This is a takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
Chuck Berry, Aretha Franklin, Ella Fitzgerald, and Louis Armstrong. Those were just a handful of the legendary musicians who had master recordings destroyed 11 years ago in a fire at Universal Studios.
Tonight, the massive day-long fire that destroyed part of Universal Studios' backlot has finally been reduced to smoking rubble.
The blaze destroyed some familiar movie sets and wiped out thousands of videos, but Universal officials say everything that was destroyed can either be replaced or rebuilt.
At the time of the fire, a representative for Universal Music Group told Deadline.com, quote, there was little loss from UMG's fault. But this week, new reporting from Jody Rosen of the New York Times revealed that over 100,000 recordings, encompassing roughly 500,000 songs, were destroyed in the incident. And that doesn't mean all of these songs are gone for good. You can probably find many of them on YouTube or Spotify, but the master tapes represent the highest quality files of some of these recordings, and their loss underscores the challenges of preserving audio in the 21st century. Andy Lancet knows a thing or two about preservation. He's the director of archives at New York Public Radio, which includes us here at WNYC. Hi, Andy. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
So what's a master recording, Andy?
A master recording is your first original take. It's what's laid down in the studio or taken, or maybe even taken off the air. It may be the only copy you have. It's really the unique item.
And why is it so important to preserve the quote-unquote master recording in this era of remixes and re-records and digital? Like, why is that recording so critical?
Because that recording has everything that was available at the time it was originally made. What you often hear from the web or recordings elsewhere are MP3 copies, let us say. Those are often lossy files, as opposed to lossless files in the digital age. That means something's missing from them. From the analog point of view, it's really the pristine first copy. If you make a copy of an analog copy using analog equipment, it's like a photocopy of a photocopy. There's something lost by the second, third, fourth generation. So you really want to go with that number one copy, the master.
Tell us a little bit about the collection that you oversee here at New York Public Radio. How far does it date back? And what are some of the different formats that you're working on preserving?
Well, we have every format pretty much used since the 1930s, except cylinder and wire. Of course, the wire came a little later in the 40s, and cylinder was prior to. So that means lacquer discs. Those lacquer discs can either be aluminum or glass-based. Certainly a lot of quarter-inch reel-to-reel tape that starts off as acetate and goes to polyester and mylar. Then there's back-coated polyester, there's VHS tape, there's F1 beta tapes, there's a whole array of items, CDR, mini disc, etc. And that collection spans, the earliest item we have goes back to 1927, actually. Lindbergh being welcomed on the steps of City Hall by Mayor Walker.
Present to Colonel Lindbergh the Medal of Valor of the City of New York.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
Lindy has now got the Medal of Valor of the City of New York pinned on him by the Honorable James J. Walker, and they are now shaking hands. The Honorable Grover A. Whalen.
We have a clip of the folk singer Woody Guthrie performing on WNYC in 1940. Let's take a listen.
Tom Joad got out of that old McAllister pen. There he got his parole after 4 long years on a man-killing charge. Tom Joad come a-walking down the road, poor boy. Tom Joad come a-walking down the road.
Andy, how did this file get preserved so that we're still able to listen to it today?
Okay, this particular recording came from a 16-inch lacquer transcription disc. If you consider your average record, LP record is 12 inches in diameter, this is a bit bigger, 16 inches. It runs at 33 and a third and gets about 15 minutes a side. Now, this, again, is a lacquer disc, which means in this case, it's actually an aluminum disc with a nitrocellulose acetate coating, and it was actually cut on a record lathe in the studio at the time of the broadcast. So it is a live air check. In this case, it was a Lead Belly's regular 15-minute show on WNYC. Now, this disc needs to be stored properly in proper temperature humidity conditions. It needs to be cleaned properly. These discs develop what is called a palmitic acid coating after a certain amount of time, and that needs to be cleaned off. And then you have to play it back on a turntable that'll accommodate a disc of that size with the proper size stylus, because you want the stylus to fit in the groove snugly, because you want to capture all that sonic information. You don't want it bouncing around, giving you extra hissing or static. And in this case, too, we're making an archival transfer. So if there are ticks and pops and clicks that can't be removed by physical cleaning, we leave them in there. That's part of the original recording as it currently exists. And if an engineer wants to do some signal processing later, they always have that original baseline to go back to.
Do events like what happened at Universal concern you about the future of audio preservation in general? Do you think there's enough being done to preserve these archives, or do you think that that's just sort of a one-off?
No, it's very concerning. It's a really sad story, and it's a real concern, well, obviously from the commercial point of view. It's certainly an issue in the radio world, because commercial radio stations notoriously for years actually threw away a lot of their recordings and collections. WNYC is one of the few places in the country where we have a sizable public radio collection. A lot of material just wasn't saved, and others were not saved in the best conditions.
Andy Lancet is the Director of Archives at New York Public Radio. Andy, thank you.
Thank you.
And just to make sure, we are going to archive this segment, right?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Thanks so much. Do you have something from your personal archive that's especially important to preserve?
Hi, my name is Jessica, and I'm calling from Seattle, Washington. My favorite item from my personal archive is my great-great-great-grandmother's engagement ring. And the best way that I preserve it is simply by wearing it. I think that items like that are meant to be worn and meant to live.
Josh Lamont in North San Jose. I keep a photo of Mom's wedding day, 19 years old in 1973, because it just reminds me everything of who she was, and I see myself and who I want to be looking at it.
My name is Darlene. I'm from Charleston, South Carolina. My favorite personal archive is a necklace that contains the hair and ashes of my Irish setter, Oliver. I only had Oliver for 3.5 months, but he stole my heart. The hair and ashes were laid in acrylic by a wonderful woman in Montreal. I wear the necklace every day.
Hi, it's Barbara McIver. I'm calling from Red Bluff, California, up in the northern Sacramento Valley. I have a framed poster that just gets dearer to me as time goes by. It's a poster signed by Fred Rogers. It's inscribed "For the McIver Family, with kindest regards, Mr. Rogers, 1990. It graces our dining room table, and it's definitely what I would grab on the way out, given a home emergency.
Hi, this is Sandy calling from Auburn, Massachusetts. My favorite archive item is a photo of our daughter on the day we first held her when we adopted her from China. She and my husband are on the hotel room floor, and our 9-month-old reached out to pinch the cheek of this new person in her life. We have digital copies on an external hard drive and on our computers, and a book of her first year published on an internet photo site. I still feel the awe and joy of that day every time I look at that photo.
Years ago today, a place of celebration for the LGBTQ community in Orlando became a scene of carnage. 49 people were killed when a gunman opened fire at Pulse nightclub in the early hours of a Sunday morning. Evidence in the trial of the shooter's wife revealed that the intent wasn't to target LGBTQ people, but the tragedy was still a call to action for many across the country. Kevin Herzog and David Moran are both part of the group Gays Against Guns, which was formed after the attack, and they're now live from Orlando. David and Kevin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
David, you lived in Orlando for decades, and I want to start by acknowledging the Pulse shooting that happened 3 years ago. What do you remember from that night?
Yeah, you know, it's still very vivid. You know, I was in grad school at the time and had been just finishing a serving shift. My friend Joanne had just come back for the summer the day before, and we both were working at the restaurant, and I was having car trouble. We had actually discussed going out either to Parliament House, which is one of the gay clubs, or Pulse, but because of my battery having an issue, we just kind of gave up and went home. I was like kind of woken up to my phone vibrating, and someone attacked me on Facebook saying that we were fine. We had worked, we were all of us who had worked at the restaurant the night before were fine, even though we could have gone out. And then I got a text from my friend Alex. We both went to Virginia Tech together, and when the Virginia Tech shooting happened there, we were living in Orlando. We had graduated in 2005, and he was the first person to text me when news was breaking about the Pulse shooting happened. So I lied in my bed and started texting my family and my friends. I didn't know who was out, who was safe, you know, and it was bringing back a lot of memories from exactly how things unfolded with the Virginia Tech shooting almost 10 years before. There was just this utter silence in my room, which I knew was completely contrasting just the horror and chaos that was going on at Pulse, a place that I basically spent my 20s kind of coming of age as an openly gay man.
David, you lost friends in the shooting, right?
I always get nervous speaking about how Pulse has impacted me because Pulse has impacted everyone and so many people around the world in different ways. You know, I immediately think of the families chosen and blood who lost loved ones, the survivors who were at the club that night that escaped. I'm a gun violence survivor myself from an armed robbery, and survivorship is so complicated. Yeah, I had seen my friend Brandon, who has since become an incredible advocate for LGBTQ plus equality and gun control, and had posted on Facebook that he and his boyfriend had gotten out of the club. And so I messaged him and he said, you know, Juan has been shot and we don't know where Drew is. You know, my heart sank and I just was like, oh God, many people were going through those same, that same kind of realization of who's missing, who can I not get in touch with? And many people did not know until the next day what the true situation was. And it all felt like a dream, a terrible dream.
Kevin, I want to bring you in here. What was the moment like for you? What did you do in the wake of the Pulse shooting?
I did what everybody does. I went on social media. That's where I found out about it, and that's where I sort of decided to do something about it. I just felt like it was this point at which it was no longer responsible to have the standard response, you know, which is like you change your Facebook profile picture and you say, oh, this is awful. And then, you know, everybody goes and has an egg salad sandwich somewhere. And there was a spontaneous vigil the next day in front of Stonewall. And I went to that. And then there was this very orchestrated vigil on Monday, the Monday evening, which was 2 days afterwards. And there were politicians and there were celebrities. And it was one of the most frustrating experiences of my life because you're there with these feelings and the feelings are getting appropriated and they're kind of like they're getting capitalized by these public figures. And I just felt to myself, you know, no, like this is not us. Like I want us to do something and I wasn't sure who us was and I wasn't sure how to make that happen. But I just thought, if not me, then who? You know, it was one of those times when I felt like, you know, it's you can't stand around looking for the other person to make the first move. So that's what I did.
And you said you were at Stonewall. And so then what ended up happening? Was that the beginning of Gays Against Guns?
The beginning of it was basically a Facebook event page. You know, it was just a notification that we were going to have a meeting and discuss what our reply or what our response was going to be to the shooting. And the original location for the meeting was my apartment. I can hold maybe 30, maybe 40 people max in my apartment. And so the response started coming in and there were hundreds of people that were interested in attending the meeting. And so I very quickly realized that we needed a larger space. Mm.
David, how has the LGBTQ community in Orlando changed since the shooting 3 years ago?
Oh, goodness. Well, I would say that there have always been many LGBTQ plus communities or experiences, you know, the intersection of gender and race and ethnicity and socioeconomic status. So one of the things that I definitely noticed was in addition to all of us trying to navigate what it means to be part of a survivor community, to navigate how to push through this trauma. And many people who had already had very traumatic things in their life, having that re-triggered. So the mental health, the self-care, and the trauma piece, I think, was a big thing. But also figuring out, what does it look like to empower people to self-determine, to self-identify, to self-lead, and problem solve what their needs are. And there was definitely a kind of a cultural gap, an intercultural gap when Pulse happened, where you were seeing many folks in leadership in the LGBTQ plus community that were primarily cis, gender, gay, and lesbian, white men, more middle class, upper class. And there was a disconnect from not necessarily intentionally, but from the reality of, you know, it was Latin night, that club. So there was much more of an intersection with brown and black folks and folks that were working at the theme parks and the hospitality industry and folks that had recently immigrated here that, you know, were not connected to the leadership. And so there was definitely a learning curve to figure out, how do we have language inclusion to support families that primarily speak Spanish or Haitian Creole? But it's been incredible to see organizations centering the intersection of the LGBTQ plus and Latinx experience in Central Florida. You know, I never imagined that there was anything that could be done around gun violence to have prevented either one of those issues. It was almost like it was inevitable. But thanks to leaders like Kevin coming down, you know, creating this space, I all of a sudden saw, wait a minute, there are things that can be done to really address that, to address different needs, because Pulse means so many different things to different people. For some folks, Pulse is political. For other folks, Pulse is personal. And for many, it's both. But, you know, people are saying, you know, I lost my mother, or my father, or my spouse, or my partner. I lost the safe space. People around the world feeling impacted, whether they're Puerto Rican or LGBTQ plus or black, or not out of the closet as gay or trans yet. That impact was felt worldwide. So it was bizarre to see rainbows everywhere. It was bizarre to see the Pulse symbol everywhere. It almost in some ways felt violating, because something that had been so personal and kind of a sacred space was now becoming everyone's. And that continues to be a journey in terms of, like, how do we really facilitate a shared custody of the Pulse legacy, of the Pulse site, that is inclusive but doesn't lose sight that it was a queer space. And it should be a queer-centered space that is intersectional and inclusive but meaningful to as many people as possible.
Tell us, Kevin, a little bit about what Gays Against Guns will be doing on this third memorial, if you will, of the Pulse nightclub shooting 3 years ago.
Every year on the marker of the shooting, we respond in some way. The first year, we closed down Sheridan Square, and we had an enormous half vigil, half celebration, which we felt was appropriate because people were still grieving and people were still focused on the idea that life goes on. And so we had performers, we had speeches, and it was attended by thousands and thousands of people, and that felt appropriate. And last year, you know, we had a more muted response, and then this year we realized we had an opportunity to come down to the space itself, which we had not done as an organization, even though what happened here was the catalyst for the formation of our group. And so when we started talking about coming down, we sort of made a very loose game plan, because we understood that we didn't want to come charging in on white horses and tell everyone we're here to save you and here's how we're going to do it. You know, we wanted to first come down, get the lay of the land, listen to what people had to say, talk to the people that are here all the time, and then figure out a way to insert ourselves into the conversation that would be supportive of them, you know, and we didn't want to be drawing attention to ourselves in any way. We were here individually for ourselves. We are here as a group, but primarily to support what's happening. So the plan that we came up with was something that's inspired by a queer artist named Felix Gonzalez Torres, who was the visual artist who lived and worked in New York, and he died of AIDS, and a lot of his work addressed AIDS. And one of the ways that he worked was he would make printouts of a particular image, and he would leave a stack of them in a gallery or in a museum. The people that came to see the artwork were encouraged to take one of the prints. We felt like that kind of a exchange between people that were attending and us was appropriate.
And I would just add, I think Gays Against Guns, for me, is an incredible tool to not feel powerless, to not feel hopeless. And I'm really grateful to Kevin and the folks from New York for your leadership with that.
David Moran is an organizer with Gays Against Guns in Orlando, and Kevin Herzog is an organizer with Gays Against Guns in New York City. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.